Asian, which is just tipping to an all-rich equilibrium, has been on the rise. Left unattended, the free market will often head to these unsatisfactory outcomes. But public policy, combined with an awareness of how tipping works, can help stop the momentum toward tipping and preserve the delicate balances. It can be lonely at the top. Top law firms generally choose their partners from among their junior associates. Those not chosen must leave the firm and generally move to a lower-ranked one. At the mythical firm Justin Case, the standards were so high that for many years no new partners were selected. The junior associates protested about this lack of advancement. The partners responded with a new system that looked very democratic. Here is what they did. At the time of the annual partnership decision, the abilities of the 10 junior associates were rated from 1 to 10, with 10 being the best. The junior associates were told their rating privately. Then they were ushered into a meeting room where they were to decide by majority vote the cutoff level for partnership. They all agreed that everyone making partner was a good idea and certainly preferable to the old days when nobody made partner. So they began with a cutoff of 1. Then, some high-rated junior associate suggested that they raise the cutoff to 2. He argued that this would improve the average quality of the partnership. 8 junior associates agreed with him. The sole dissenting vote came from the least able member, who would no longer make partner. Next, someone proposed that they raise the standard from 2 to 3. 8 people were still above this standard, and they all voted for this improvement in the quality of the partnership. The person ranked 2 voted against, as this move deprived him of partnership. What was surprising was that the lowest-rated junior associate was in favor of this raising of the standards. In neither case would he make partner, but at least in the latter, he would be grouped with someone who had ability, too. Therefore, upon seeing that he was not selected, other law firms would not be able to infer his exact ability. They would guess that he was either a 1 or a 2, a level of uncertainty that would be to his advantage. The proposal to raise the standard to 3 passed 9-1. With each new cutoff level, someone proposed raising it by 1. All those strictly above voted in favor so as to raise the quality of the partnership without sacrificing their own position, while all those strictly below joined in support of raising the standard so as to make their failure less consequential. Each time there was only one dissenter, the associate right at the cutoff level who would no longer make partner, but he was outvoted 9-1. And so it went, until the standard was raised all the way up to 10. Finally, someone proposed that they raise the standard to 11, so that nobody would make partner. Everybody rated 9 and below thought that this was a fine proposal, since once more this improved the average quality of those rejected. Outsiders would not take it as a bad sign that they didn't make partner, as nobody made partner at this law firm. The sole voice against was the most able junior associate, who lost his chance to make partner. But he was outvoted 9-1. The series of votes brought everybody back to the old system, which they all considered worse than the alternative of promotion for all. Even so, each resolution along the way passed 9-1. There are two morals to this story. When actions are taken in a piecemeal way, each step of the way can appear attractive to the vast majority of decision-makers. But the end is worse than the beginning for everyone. The reason is that voting ignores the intensity of preferences. In our example, all those in favor gain a small amount, while the one person against loses a lot. In the series of 10 votes, each junior associate has 9 small victories and 1 major loss that outweighs all the combined gains. Similar problems tend to plague bills involving reforms of taxes or trade tariffs. They get killed by a series of amendments. Each step gets a majority approval, but the end result has enough fatal flaws so that it loses the support of a majority. just because an individual recognizes the problem does not mean an individual can stop the process. It is a slippery slope, too dangerous to get onto. The group as a whole must look ahead and reason back in a coordinated way, and set up the rules so as to prevent taking the first steps on the slope. There is safety when individuals agree to consider reforms only as a package rather than as a series of small steps. With a package deal, everyone knows where he will end up. A series of small steps can look attractive at first, but one unfavorable move can more than wipe out the entire series of gains. In 1989, Congress learned this danger firsthand in its failed attempt to vote itself a 50% pay raise. Initially, the pay raise seemed to have wide support in both houses. When the public realized what was about to happen, they protested loudly to their representatives. Consequently, each member of Congress had a private incentive to vote against the pay hike, provided he or she thought that the hike would still pass. The best scenario would be to get the higher salary while having protested against it. Unfortunately for them, too many members of Congress took this approach, and suddenly passage no longer seemed certain. As each defection moved them further down the slippery slope, there was all the more reason to vote against it. If the pay hike were to fail, the worst possible position would be to go on record supporting the salary hike, pay the political price, and yet not get the raise. At first, there was the potential for a few individuals to selfishly improve their own position. But each defection increased the incentive to follow suit, and soon enough, the proposal was dead. There is a second, quite different moral to the Justin Case story. If you are going to fail, you might as well fail at a difficult task. Failing causes others to downgrade their expectations of you in the future. The seriousness of this problem depends on what you attempt. Failure to climb Mount Everest is considerably less damning than failure to finish a 10K race. The point is that when other people's perception of your ability matters, it might be better for you to do things that increase your chance of failing in order to reduce its consequence. People who apply to Harvard instead of the local college, or ask the most popular student to prom instead of a more realistic prospect, are following such strategies. Psychologists see this behavior in other contexts. Some individuals are afraid to recognize the limits of their own ability. In these cases, they take actions that increase the chance of failure in order to avoid facing their ability. For example, a marginal student may not study for a test so that if he fails, the failure can be blamed on his lack of studying rather than intrinsic ability. Although perverse and counterproductive, there is no invisible hand to protect you in games against yourself. Politicians and apple cider. Two political parties are trying to choose their positions on the liberal-conservative ideological spectrum. First, the incumbent takes a stand. Then the challenger responds. Suppose the voters range uniformly over the spectrum. For concreteness, number the political positions from 0 to 100, where 0 represents radical left and 100 represents arch-conservative. If the incumbent chooses a position such as 48, slightly more liberal than the middle of the road, the challenger will take a position between that and the middle, say 49. Then voters with preferences of 48 and under will vote for the incumbent. All others, making up just over 51% of the population, will vote for the challenger. The challenger will win. If the incumbent takes a position above 50, then the challenger will locate between that and 50. Again, this will get him more than half the votes. By the principle of looking ahead and reasoning backward, the incumbent can figure out that his best bet is to locate right in the middle. As with highways, the position in the middle of the road is called the median. When voters' preferences are not necessarily uniform, the incumbent locates at the position where 50% of the voters are located to the left and 50% are to the right. This median is not necessarily the average position. The median position is determined by where there are an equal number of voices on each side, while the average gives weight to how far the voices are away. At this location, the forces pulling for more conservative or more liberal positions have equal numbers. The best the challenger can do is imitate the incumbent. The two parties take identical stands, so each gets 50% of the votes if issues are the only thing that counts. The losers in this process are the voters, who get an echo rather than a choice. In practice, parties do not take identical hard positions, but each fudges its stand around the middle ground. This phenomenon was first recognized by Columbia University economist Harold Hodelin in 1929. He pointed out similar examples in economic and social affairs. Our cities become uneconomically large, and the business districts within them are too concentrated. Methodist and Presbyterian churches are too much alike. Cider is too homogeneous. Would the excess homogeneity persist if there were three parties? Suppose they take turns to choose and revise their positions and have no ideological baggage to tie them down. A party located on the outside will edge closer to its neighbor to chip away some of its support. This will squeeze the party in the middle to such an extent that when its turn comes, it will want to jump to the outside and acquire a whole new and larger base of voters. This process will then continue, and there will be no equilibrium. In practice, parties have enough ideological baggage and voters have enough party loyalty to prevent such rapid switches. In other cases, locations won't be fixed. Consider three people all looking for a taxi in Manhattan. Though they start waiting at the same time, the one at the most uptown position will catch the first taxi going downtown, and the one located farthest downtown will catch the first uptown cab. The one in the middle is squeezed out. If the middle person isn't willing to be usurped, he will move either uptown or downtown to preempt one of the other two. Until the taxi arrives, there may not be an equilibrium. No individual is content to remain squeezed in the middle. Here we have yet another and quite different failure of an uncoordinated decision process. It may not have a determinate outcome at all. In such a situation, society has to find a different and coordinated way of reaching a stable outcome. A recapitulation. In this chapter, we described many instances in which the games people play have more losers than winners. Uncoordinated choices interact to produce a poor outcome for society. Let us summarize the problems briefly, and you can then try out the ideas on the case study. First, we looked at games in which each person had an either-or choice. One problem was the familiar multi-person prisoner's dilemma. Everyone made the same choice, and it was the wrong one. Next, we saw examples in which some people made one choice while their colleagues made another, but the proportions were not optimal from the standpoint of the group as a whole. This happened because one of the choices involved spillovers, that is, effects on others, which the choosers failed to take into account. Then we had situations in which either extreme, everyone choosing one thing or everyone choosing the other, was in equilibrium. To choose one, or make sure the right one was chosen, required social conventions, penalties, or restraints on people's behavior. Even then, powerful historical forces might keep the group locked into the wrong equilibrium. Turning to situations with several alternatives, we saw how the group could voluntarily slide down a slippery path to an outcome it would collectively regret. In other examples, we found a tendency toward excessive homogeneity. Sometimes there might be an equilibrium held together by people's mutually reinforcing expectations about what others think. In still other cases, equilibrium might fail to exist altogether, and another way to reach a stable outcome would have to be found. The point of these stories is that the free market doesn't always get it right. There are two fundamental problems. One is that history matters. Our greater experience with gasoline engines, QWERTY keyboards, and light water nuclear reactors may lock us in to continued use of these inferior technologies. Accidents of history cannot necessarily be corrected by today's market. When one looks forward to recognize that lock-in will be a potential problem, this provides a reason for government policy to encourage more diversity before the standard is set. Or, if we seem stuck with an inferior standard, public policy can guide a coordinated change from one standard to another. Moving from measurements in inches and feet to the metric system is one example. Coordinating the use of daylight saving time is another. Inferior standards may be behavioral rather than technological. Examples include an equilibrium in which everyone cheats on his taxes or drives above the speed limit, or even just arrives at parties an hour after the stated time. The move from one equilibrium to a better one can be most effectively accomplished via a short and intense campaign. The trick is to get a critical mass of people to switch, and then the bandwagon effect makes the new equilibrium self-sustaining. In contrast, a little bit of pressure over a long period of time would not have the same effect. The other general problem with laissez-faire is that so much of what matters in life takes place outside the economic marketplace. Goods ranging from common courtesy to clean air are frequently unpriced, so there is no invisible hand to guide selfish behavior. Sometimes creating a price can solve the problem, as with congestion on the Bay Bridge. Other times, pricing the good changes its nature. For example, donated blood is typically superior to blood that is purchased because the types of individuals who sell their blood for money are likely to be in a much poorer state of health. The coordination failures illustrated in this chapter are meant to show the role for public policy. But before you get carried away, check the case below. Case study: A prescription for allocating dentists. In this case study, we explore the coordination problem of how the invisible hand allocates or misallocates the supply of dentists between cities and rural areas. In many ways, the problem will seem closely related to our analysis of whether to drive or take the train from Berkeley to San Francisco. Will the invisible hand guide the right numbers to each place? It is often argued that there is not so much a shortage of dentists as a problem of misallocation. Just as too many drivers, left to their own resources, would take the Bay Bridge, is it the case that too many dentists choose the city over the countryside? And if so, does that mean society should place a toll on those who want to practice city dentistry? For the purposes of this case study, we greatly simplify the dentist's decision problem. Living in the city or in the countryside are considered equally attractive. The choice is based solely on financial considerations. They go where they will earn the most money. Like the commuters between Berkeley and San Francisco, the decision is made selfishly. Dentists maximize their individual payoffs. Since there are many rural areas without enough dentists, this suggests that there is room for an increased number of dentists to practice in rural areas without causing any congestion. Thus, rural dentistry is like the train route. At its best, being a rural dentist is not quite as lucrative as having a large city practice, but it is a more certain route to an above-average income. Both the incomes and the value to society of rural dentists stay roughly constant as their numbers grow. Being a city practitioner is akin to driving over the Bay Bridge. It is wonderful when you are alone and not so great when the city gets too crowded. The first dentist in an area can be extremely valuable and maintain a large practice. But with too many dentists around, there is the potential for congestion and price competition. As the number increases, city dentists will be competing for the same patient pool, and their talents will be underutilized. If the population of city dentists grows too much, they may end up earning less than their rural counterparts. In short, as the number of city practices increases, the value of the marginal service that they perform falls, as does their income. We depict this story in a simple chart, again, quite similar to the driving versus train example. Suppose there are 100,000 new dentists choosing between city and rural practices. Thus, if the number of new city dentists is 25,000, then there will be 75,000 new rural dentists. The falling line, city dentists, and the flat line, rural dentists, represent the financial advantages of taking the respective paths. At the far left, where everyone chooses rural practices, city dentists' incomes are above the incomes of those with rural practices. This is reversed at the far right, where everyone chooses city dentistry. The equilibrium for career choices is at E, where the two options provide the same financial rewards. To verify this, suppose that the distribution of career choice results in only 25,000 new city dentists. Since city dentists' incomes are higher there than rural dentists' incomes, we expect that more new dentists will choose city over rural practices. This will move the distribution of city versus rural to the right. The reverse adjustment would take place if we started to the right of E, where city dentists are the lower paid of the two. Only when E is reached will next year's career choices broadly replicate those of this year, and the system will settle down to an equilibrium. Is this outcome the best for society? Case discussion. As in the case of the commuters, the equilibrium does not maximize the combined income of dentists. But society cares about the consumers of dentistry as well as the practitioners. In fact, left alone, the market solution at E is the best for society as a whole. The reason is that there are two side effects created when one more person decides to be a city dentist. The additional city dentist lowers all other dentists' incomes, imposing a cost on the existing city dentists. But this reduction in price is a benefit to consumers. The two side effects exactly cancel each other out. The difference between this story and our commuting example is that no one benefited from the extra commuting time when the Bay Bridge became congested. When the side effect is a change in price or income, then the purchasers benefit at the producer's cost. There is zero net effect. From society's viewpoint, a dentist should not worry about lowering colleagues' incomes. Each dentist should pursue the highest-paying practice. As each person makes a selfish choice, we are invisibly led to the right distribution of dentists between city and rural areas. And the two careers will have equal incomes. Or, to the extent that living in a city is worth more than living in a rural area, this differential will be reflected in income differences. Of course, the American Dental Association may look at this differently. It may place more weight on the loss to city dentists' incomes than on the saving to consumers. From the dental profession's perspective, there is indeed a misallocation with too many dentists practicing in the city. If more dentists took rural practices, then the potential advantages of a city practice would not be wasted by competition and congestion. Taken as a whole, the income of dentists would rise if it were possible to keep the number of city dentists below the free market level. Although dentists cannot place a toll on those who want to practice in the city, it is in the profession's self-interest to create a fund that subsidizes dental students who commit to establish a rural practice. For some more case studies on cooperation and coordination, see Here's Mud in Your Eye, A Burqa for Prices, and The King Lear Problem in Chapter 14. Chapter 10. Auctions, Bidding, and Contests. It wasn't that long ago that the typical image of an auction was that of an auctioneer with a snooty British accent calling out to a hushed room of bejeweled art collectors sitting in Louis XIV chairs and tugging at their ears to bid. With eBay, auctions have become just a touch more democratic. The most familiar auction is where an item is put up for sale and the high bidder wins. At Sotheby's, it is a painting or an antique. On eBay, It is a Pez dispenser, a used drum set, or almost anything except a kidney. On Google and Yahoo, auctions for ad positions next to keyword searches bring in well over $10 billion. In Australia, even houses are sold via auctions. The common denominator is that we have one seller and many buyers. The buyers compete against each other to gain the object, and the high bidder wins. The view of an auction as a way to sell something is too narrow. Auctions are also used to buy items. A good illustration is where a local government wants to build a road and takes bids to determine who will build the road. Here the winning bidder is the one who makes the lowest bid, as the government wants to buy the paving service as cheaply as possible. This is called a procurement auction. There's one buyer and many sellers to get the buyer's business. Procurement auctions are more complicated because the bidders aren't using identical currencies. In a normal auction, when Avinash bids $20 and Barry bids $25, the seller knows that $25 is a better bid. But in a procurement auction, it is clear that Avinash's offer to build a road for $20 is better than Barry's offer of $25. The quality of work may be different. This explains why reverse auctions wouldn't work well on eBay. Imagine you wanted to buy a Pearl Export drum set. This is a fairly common item on eBay, and there are usually a dozen or more sets for sale at any time. To run a procurement auction, you would need all of the sellers to bid against each other. At the auction close, you'd then buy the drum set at the lowest bid, assuming it was below your reservation number. The problem is that you might care about the color, or age of the drums, or the reputation of the seller for reliability and prompt delivery. The lowest bid isn't necessarily the best one. But if you aren't always going to pick the lowest bid, then the sellers don't know how low they need to bid in order to win your business. A solution, which often works better in theory than in practice, is to impose performance standards. The problem is that bidders who would perform above the minimum standard are often not rewarded for doing so in their bid. Because procurement auctions are more complicated in this way, we focus our attention on regular auctions. Bidding in an auction requires a strategy, though many people think all they need is a paddle. That leads to problems when people bid based on emotion or excitement. They live to regret it. To do well in an auction setting requires a strategy. Should you bid early or wait until the auction is almost over and then jump in? If you value an item at $100, how high should you bid? How do you avoid winning the auction but then regretting that you've overpaid? As we have discussed before, this phenomenon is known as the winner's curse. Here, we'll explain how to avoid it. Should you even bid in the auction? The house auction market in Australia illustrates the buyer's dilemma. Imagine that you are interested in a house that is due to be auctioned on July 1. But there's a house you like even more that will be auctioned off a week later. Do you wait to bid in the second auction and risk ending up with neither? Our plan is to start with a description of some basic auction types and then discuss how game theory can help you bid and know when not to. English and Japanese auctions. The most famous type of auction is known as the English or ascending auction. In this format, the auctioneer stands at the front of the room calling out ever-increasing bids.
Do I hear 30? 30 from the lady in the pink hat.
40? Yes, 40 from the gentleman on my left. Will someone bid 50? 50 anyone? 40 going once, going twice. Sold. Here the optimal bidding strategy, although it hardly merits the term strategy, is simple. You bid until the price exceeds your value, and then you drop out. There is often a bit of trickiness over the issue of bidding increments. Imagine that the bidding goes up in units of 10, and your value is 95. Then you would stop bidding at 90. Of course, knowing that, you might want to think about whether you should be the high bidder at 70 or 80, recognizing that 90 will be your last bid.
In the discussion that follows, we will assume that the bidding increments are very small, say a penny, so that these endgame issues are not important. The only hard part is determining what is meant by your value. What we mean by your value is your walkaway number. It is the highest price at which you still want to win the item. At a dollar more, you would rather pass, and at a dollar less, you are willing to pay the price, but just barely. Your value might include a premium you put on not having the item fall into a rival's hands. It could include the excitement of winning the bidding. It could include the expected resale value in the future. When all of the components are put together, it is the number such that if you had to pay that price, you no longer care if you've won or lost the auction. Values come in two flavors, private and common. In a world of private values, your value for the item doesn't depend at all on what others think it is worth. Thus, your value of a personalized signed copy of The Art of Strategy doesn't depend on what your neighbor might think it is worth. In a common value situation, the bidders understand that the item has the same value for all of them, although each might have a different view as to what that common value is. A standard example is bidding for an offshore oil lease. There is some amount of oil underground. While that amount might be unknown, it is the same whether Exxon or Shell wins the bidding. In truth, the value of an item usually has elements of both private and common components. Thus, one oil company might be better at extracting the oil than the other, which then adds a private value element to something that is mostly common. In situations with a common value, your best guess as to the value of an item might depend on who else or how many others are bidding and when they drop out. An English auction keeps that information hidden, as you never know who else is willing to bid but hasn't yet moved. Nor are you sure when someone has dropped out. You know their last bid, but not how high they would have gone. There is a variation of the English auction that is more transparent. In something called a Japanese auction, all of the bidders start with their hands raised or buttons pressed. The bidding goes up via a clock. The clock might start at 30 and then proceed to 31, 32, and upwards. So long as your hand is raised, you are in the bidding. You drop out by lowering your hand. The catch is that once you lower your hand, you can't put it back up again. The auction ends when only one bidder remains. An advantage of the Japanese auction is that it is always clear how many bidders are active. In an English auction, someone can remain silent even though they were willing to bid all along. The person can then make a surprise entry late in the contest. In the Japanese auction, you know exactly how many competitors there are and even the prices at which each drops out. The Japanese auction is thus just like an English auction where everyone has to reveal their hand. The outcome of a Japanese auction is easy to predict. Since bidders drop out when the price hits their value, the last person remaining will be the one with the highest valuation. The price the winner will pay will equal the second highest valuation. The reason is that the auction ends at the moment the second-to-last bidder drops out. The last price is the valuation of the second-highest bidder. Thus, the item is sold to the person with the highest valuation, and the seller receives a payment equal to the second-highest valuation. Vickrey Auction. In 1961, Columbia University economist and future Nobel laureate William Vickrey developed a different type of auction. He called it a second price auction, though we now call it a Vickrey auction in his honor. In a Vickrey auction, all the bids are placed in a sealed envelope. When the envelopes are opened to determine the winner, the highest bid wins. But there's a twist. The winner doesn't pay his or her bid. Instead, the winner only has to pay the second highest bid. What is remarkable, even magical, about this auction is that all the bidders have a dominant strategy: bid their true valuation. In a regular sealed bid auction,
where the high bidder wins and pays his actual bid, bidding strategy is a complicated problem. What you should bid depends on how many other bidders are in the game, what you think their value is for the item, even what you think they think your value is. The result is a complicated game where everyone has to consider what everyone else is doing. In a Vickrey auction, all you have to do is figure out what the item is worth to you and then write down that amount. You don't need to hire a game theorist to help you bid, alas. Actually, we like that result. Our goal is to be strategic when designing a game so that the players don't have to be strategic when they play it. The reason why your bidding strategy is so simple is that it is a dominant strategy. A dominant strategy is your best play no matter what others are doing. Thus, you don't need to know how many others there are or what they are thinking or doing. Your best strategy doesn't depend on what anyone else bids. This brings us to the question of how we know that bidding your valuation is a dominant strategy. The following example is the basis of the general argument. You are in a Vickrey auction, and your true value of the item is $60. But instead of bidding $60, you bid $50. To show that this is a bad idea, we put on our consequentialist hat. When does bidding $50 rather than $60 lead to a different outcome? Actually, it is easier to turn this question around. When does bidding $50 or $60 lead to the same result? If someone else bids $63 or $70 or anything else above $60, then both $50 and $60 are losing bids. Hence, there is no difference between them. In both cases, you lose the auction and walk away with nothing. The $50 and $60 bids also lead to identical, but this time happier, outcomes if the highest other bid is below $50, say $43. If you bid $60, then you win and pay $43. If you had bid $50, you would have also won and paid $43. The reason is that in both cases, you are the highest bidder, and what you pay is the second highest bid, which is $43. Bidding $50 doesn't save you any money compared to bidding $60, when the second highest bid is $43, or anything below $50. We've looked at the cases in which the two bids lead to exactly the same result. Based on these cases, there is no reason to prefer one bid over the other. What is left is where the paths diverge. This is how we can judge which bid leads to a better result. There's no difference if any rival bid is above $60 or all are below $50. The only remaining case is where the highest competitive bid is between $50 and $60, say $53. If you bid $60, then you will win and pay $53. If you were to have bid $50, then you would lose. Since your value is $60, you would rather win and pay $53 than lose. Thus, the only time a bid of $50 leads to a different outcome than one of $60 is when you lose the auction but you wished you had won. This demonstrates that you never want to bid $50 or anything below your true value. A similar argument shows that you never want to bid more than your true value. Trip to the gym number 6. Imagine that you could find out how much the other bidders were submitting in a Vickrey auction before you had to put in your bid. Ignoring the ethical issues for a moment, how much would this be worth to you? Revenue equivalence. At this point, you may have figured out that the Vickrey auction gets you to the same outcome as the English or Japanese auction, all in one step. In both cases, the person with the highest value ends up winning the auction. In both cases, what the winning bidder has to pay is the second highest valuation. In the English or Japanese auction, everyone bids up to his or her value, so the auction ends when the bidding gets up to the second highest valuation. The remaining bidder is the person with the highest value. And subject to the vagaries of the bidding interval, what the winning bidder pays is the bid at which the penultimate bidder drops out, namely, the second highest valuation.
In the Vickrey auction, everyone bids his or her true value. Thus, the person with the highest valuation is the winning bidder. According to the rules, that person only has to pay the second highest bid, which is just the second highest valuation. Thus, it appears that the two auctions get to exactly the same place. The same person wins, and the winner pays the same price. Of course, there is always the issue of the bidding interval, in that the person with a valuation of 95 might drop out at 90 if the bidding increment comes in tens. But with small enough increments, the person will drop out just at the valuation. There is one subtle difference between the two auctions. In the English auction, a bidder learns something about what others think the item is worth by seeing some of their bids. There are many potential bids that are not seen. In the Japanese variant, the bidders learn even more. Everyone sees where everyone drops out. In contrast, in the Vickrey auction, the winning bidder doesn't get a chance to learn anything about the other bids until the auction is all over. Of course, in a private value auction, a bidder doesn't care about what others think the item is worth. Thus, the extra information is irrelevant. This allows us to conclude that in a private value setting, the seller would make the same amount of money by employing a Vickrey auction or an English or Japanese auction. It turns out that this is part of a much more general result. In many cases, a change in the rules doesn't lead to any more or less revenue to the seller. Buyer's premium. If you win an auction at Sotheby's or Christie's, you might be surprised to learn that you owe more than you bid. This isn't just sales tax we are talking about. The auction houses tack on a 20% buyer's premium. If you win the auction with a $1,000 bid, you will be expected to write them a check for $1,200. Who pays the buyer's premium? The obvious answer is the buyer. But if the answer were really that obvious, we surely wouldn't have asked the question. Or would we? Just to keep you honest. Okay, it isn't the buyer who pays, it's the seller. To get this result, all we need to assume is that the buyer is aware of this rule and takes it into account when bidding. Put yourself in the position of a collector who is willing to pay $600. How high will you bid? Your top bid should be $500, as you can anticipate that saying $500 really means that you have to pay $600 after the buyer's premium. You can think of the buyer's premium as being nothing more than a currency conversion or a code. When you say $100, you really mean $120. Each bidder scales back his bid accordingly. One way to think of this game is that it is as if the auction is conducted in New York, but the bidding is in euros. Thus, when a bidder says 500 euros, he or she expects to pay $600. It should be clear that changing the currency used for bidding shouldn't bring in more money to the auction. If Sotheby's said that Monday's auction would be conducted in euros, everyone could do the calculation to translate their bid into dollars or yen for that matter. They understand the true cost of bidding 100 whatever the units. If your winning bid is $100, you have to write a check for $120. You don't care that the $120 is divided up $100 to the seller and $20 to the auction house. You only care that the painting costs $120. From your perspective, you can just as well imagine that the buyer receives the full $120 and then turns over $20 to the auction house. Our point is that the winning bidder still pays the same amount. The only difference is that now the auction house gets some percentage of the total. Thus, the cost is borne entirely by the seller, not the buyer. The larger takeaway here is that you may change the rules of the game, but the players will adapt their strategies to take those new rules into account. In many cases, they will precisely offset what you've done. Online auctions. While the Vickrey auction may go all the way back to Goethe, it was still relatively uncommon until recently. It has now become the standard for online auctions. Take the case of eBay. You don't bid directly in an eBay auction. Instead, you do something called a proxy bid. You authorize eBay to bid up to your proxy. Thus, if you give them a proxy bid of $100 and the current high bid is $12, eBay will first bid $13 for you. If that bid is high enough to win, that's where they stop. But if someone else has put a proxy bid of $26, then eBay will bid up to $26 for that person, and your proxy will go all the way up to $27. It would seem that this is just like a Vickrey auction. Think of the proxy bids as being like the bids in a Vickrey auction. The person with the highest proxy bid ends up being the winner, and the amount the person pays is equal to the second highest proxy bid. To make this concrete, imagine there are three proxy bids. A, $26. B, $33. C, $100. A's proxy will drop out once the bidding gets to $26. B's proxy will force the bidding up to that level. And C's proxy will push the bidding all the way up to $34. Thus, C will win the auction and pay the second highest proxy bid, plus a dollar. If everyone had to submit their proxy bids at the same time and once and for all, the game truly would be the same as a Vickrey auction, and we could advise everyone to play it straight and bid their true value. Bidding the truth would be a dominant strategy. But the game isn't quite played that way, and these little hiccups lead people to get fancy with their bids. One complication is that eBay will often have several similar items for sale all at the same time. Thus, if you want to buy a used Pearl Export drum set, you have a choice of 10 or so to choose from at any one time. You might like to bid on whichever one is cheapest, up to $400. While you are willing to pay up to $400 for any one of the sets, you wouldn't bid $300 on one version while another might be bought at $250. You might also prefer to bid in an auction that is closing sooner over one that ends in a week, so you don't have to wait to know whether or not you've won. What this comes down to is that your value of the item being sold depends on what else is up for sale, both now and in the future. Thus, you can't place a valuation independent of the auction. Sniping. Let's take a case where multiple items and issues of timing aren't a concern. Consider an auction for a one-of-a-kind item. Now, is there any reason not to play it straight and enter your true value in your proxy bid? As an empirical matter, people don't play it straight. They often wait until the last minute, or even second, before entering their best proxy bid. The name for this is sniping. Indeed, there are internet services such as Bidnapper and others that will do the sniping for you so you don't have to wait around for the auction to end before submitting your bid. Why snipe? We've shown that bidding your true value is a dominant strategy in a Vickrey auction. Sniping must arise because of the subtle differences between proxy bidding and a Vickrey auction. The key difference is that the other bidders might get to learn something from your proxy bid before the auction is over. If what they learn influences how they bid, then you can have an incentive to keep your bid, even your proxy bid, hidden. An early proxy bid might give away valuable information. For example, if a furniture dealer bids on a specific Bauhaus chair, you might, quite reasonably, infer that the piece is authentic and of historical interest. If the dealer is willing to buy the chair at a price of $1,000, then you would be happy to pay $1,200, a better price than you could hope to get from that same dealer. Thus, the dealer doesn't want others to know how high he or she is willing to go. That leads the dealer to wait until the very end before putting in a bid. At that point, it is too late for you or others to react. By the time you've discovered the dealer is bidding, the auction is over. Of course, that implies that the bidder's true identity is known to others, and that the bidder can't come up with an alias. Since sniping is so common, that suggests there are other explanations. We think the best explanation for sniping is that many bidders don't know their own value. Take the case of a vintage Porsche 911. The bidding starts at $1. Of course, we don't value the car at $1. We value the car at $100, even at $1,000. Provided the bidding is below $1,000, we can be confident that this is a great deal. We don't have to look up the Blue Book value or even speak to our spouse about the need for an extra car. The point here is that we are lazy. Figuring out our true value for an item takes work. If we can win the auction without ever having to go through that effort, we would prefer to take the shortcut. This is where sniping comes into play. Imagine that our expert buyer values the vintage Porsche at $19,000. The buyer would prefer to keep the bidding low for as long as possible. If the buyer enters a $19,000 proxy at the start, then our mindless proxy bid of $1,000 will push the price right up to $1,000. At that point, we will learn that we need to get more information. In the process, our spouse might go along for the ride and let us bid up to $9,000. That could push the final price up to $9,000, or higher if other bidders get a chance to do their homework. But if the $19,000 proxy bidder keeps his or her powder dry, then the bidding may not escalate above $1,000 until the last moments of the auction, at which point it is too late for us to re-enter a higher bid, assuming we were even paying attention and could get the quick okay from the spouse to bid more. The reason to snipe is to keep others in the dark about their own valuations. You don't want people to learn that their lazy bid doesn't have a chance to win. If they find out early enough, they will have a chance to do their homework, which can only lead to you having to pay more, if you still win. Bidding as if you've won. A powerful idea in game theory is the concept of acting like a consequentialist. By that we mean to look ahead and see where your actions have consequences. You should then assume that situation is the relevant one at the time of your initial play. It turns out that this perspective is critical in auctions and in life. It is the key tool to avoid the winner's curse. To make this concrete, imagine that you ask someone to marry you. The person can say yes or no. If the answer is no, then there's nothing for you to go through with. But if the answer is yes, then you are on your way to getting hitched. Our point is that you should presume the answer will be yes at the time you pop the question. We are well aware that this is taking an optimistic perspective. Your intended could say no, and you will be very disappointed. The reason to assume that your intended will say yes is to be prepared for that outcome. In that case, you should be saying yes as well. If upon hearing that your intended says yes, you then want to reconsider, you shouldn't have asked in the first place. In a marriage proposal, assuming the answer will be yes is a pretty natural way of going about things. In the case of negotiations and auctions, this is an approach that has to be learned. Try your hand at the following game. Acme. You are a potential buyer for Acme. Because of your extensive knowledge of game theory, you will be able to increase Acme's value by 50%, whatever it is. The problem is that you have some doubts as to the current value. After completing your due diligence, you place the value at somewhere between $2 million and $12 million. The average value is $7 million, and your view is that all the options in the $2 to $12 million range are equally likely. The way the bidding is set up, you get to make a single take-it-or-leave-it bid to the owners. They will accept any bid that exceeds the current value and reject otherwise. Say that you bid $10 million. If it turns out that the company is presently worth $8 million, then you can make it worth $12 million. You will pay $10 million for a company worth $12 million, and so your profit will be $2 million. If the company is only worth $4 million, then you will make it worth $6 million, but have paid $10 million, and thus end up $4 million behind. What is the most you can offer the current owners and still expect to break even? By break even, we mean that you might not make money in every situation, but on average, you'll neither make nor lose any money. Note that we don't recommend bidding this amount. You should always bid something less than this amount. This is just a way of figuring out a cap on your bids. When faced with this problem, most people reason as follows. On average, the company is worth $7 million. I can make it worth 50% more, or $10.5 million. Thus, I can bid up to $10.5 million and still not expect to lose money. Is $10.5 million where you came out? We hope not. Think back to the marriage proposal. You've proposed an acquisition here. What if they say yes? Do you still want to go ahead? If you offered $10.5 million and the owners say yes, then you've learned some bad news. You now know that the company is not worth $11 million or $12 million today. When the owners say yes to an offer of $10.5 million, the company will be worth somewhere between $2 million and $10.5 million, or $6.25 million on average. The problem is that even with your 50% increase in performance, that only brings up the value to $9.375 million, well below the $10.5 million you offered. This is a serious problem. It appears that if they say yes, then you no longer want to buy the company. The solution to this problem is to presume that your offer will be accepted. In that case, if you were to offer $8 million, you can predict that when it is accepted, the company is worth between $2 million and $8 million, for an average value of $5 million. A 50% premium on $5 million only gets you up to $7.5 million, not enough to justify the $8 million offer. An offer of $6 million just does the trick. You can anticipate that when the seller says yes, the company is worth between $2 million and $6 million, for an average value of $4 million. The 50% premium brings the value to you back up to $6 million, or break-even. The fact that the seller says yes is bad news, but not fatal to the deal. You have to adjust down your offer to take into account the circumstances under which a seller will say yes to you. If you are wondering how we came up with the $6 million, here's the calculation to employ. If an offer of X dollars is accepted, then the seller's value is between 2 and X for an average value of 2 plus X divided by 2. You make the company worth an extra 50% or 1.5 times the original value. Break-even implies that your bid of X equals 3 divided by 2 times 2 plus X divided by 2, or 4X equals 3 times 2 plus X, or X equals 6. It is easier to check that 6 is the right answer than to come up with the number. Let's put this all together. If you offer $6 million and you presume that your offer will be accepted, then you anticipate that the company will only be worth $4 million and you won't be disappointed when your offer is accepted. Quite often, your offer will be rejected, in which case you will have underestimated the value of the company. But in those cases, you don't end up with the company, so the mistake doesn't matter. This idea of presuming you've won is a critical ingredient to making the right bid in a sealed bid auction. Sealed bid auctions. The rules of a sealed bid auction are simple. Everyone puts his or her bid in a sealed envelope. The envelopes are opened and the high bidder wins and pays his or her bid. The tricky part of a sealed bid auction is determining how much to bid. For starters, you should never bid your valuation, or worse, something more. If you do so, you are guaranteed to break even at best. This strategy is dominated by shading your bid to some amount below your valuation. That way, at least you have a chance to come out ahead. How much you should shade your bid depends on how many others are competing in the auction and what you expect others to bid. But what they bid depends on what they expect you to bid. The key step to cutting through this infinite loop of expectations is to always bid as if you've won. When putting down your bid, you should always assume that all of the other bidders are below you. And then, with that assumption, you should ask,
if this is your best bid. Of course, you will often be wrong when making that assumption. But when you're wrong, it won't matter. Others will have outbid you, and so you won't have won the auction. But when you're right, you'll be the